The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The U.S. is confirming that they're going to be sending additional troops to Taiwan. That is big news. It is historic because the troops will deploy to the crucial island to help build out a training program amid increasing tensions with China.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, we need to pray for China. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. We need to pray for our own country as well and for the world. I remember years ago, I had the privilege of meeting an incredible woman of God, a woman who Padre Pio was her spiritual director, who had the ability to bilocate, levitate, read souls. Her cause is now open for sainthood, and her name was Maria Esperanza. She lived down in South America, and I remember being in her home one day, and I saw this beautiful image. She was an artist as well, and she painted an image of Our Lady with the rays coming from her hand, and she was standing behind in front of all these people, and it was on the continent of China. And again, I've shared this in the past. Virgin Mary, Maria Esperanza, knew, and this is 1993, 1994, she said China would rise. And we're seeing it today, right? In both global dominance, we're seeing it economically. They're working with Brazil to try to get off the digital, to get off the U.S. dollar. They are now trying to divide Europe. They are partnering up with Vladimir Putin. They are warning the U.S., hey, knock it off. The Taiwan's president, has warned that, you know, China's war games over Taiwan, which are still now ongoing, 3 days of these with armed aircraft and ships and even some nuclear armed craft. The Taiwanese president warned that, you know, this could set off a war, it could set off a world war. China said at the outset that these exercises are going to last at least 3 days. And Taiwan's foreign minister, a guy named Joseph Wu, he said that if you look at the sorties of the Chinese Air Force together with the ships that are coming very close to Taiwan, any accident could start an uncontrollable war between Taiwan and China. And if other countries are trying to intervene, it might start a war of a greater scale. And I say, let's pray that doesn't happen. What will the U.S. do? That's the million-dollar question. I guess in today's dollars, it's a trillion-dollar question, right? It's what would we do? Will we defend them? And many people believe that the answer is yes. Tomorrow, I'm not going to do it today, but tomorrow I'm going to dive into some of the geopolitics of the changing landscape for America, the desire to get off the petrodollar, the division that we're now seeing amongst world powers, France. I don't know if you heard about this or not. We'll get into this tomorrow. Emmanuel Macron, who's the president of France, he said a couple things that should give, I think, everybody pause. He said that Europe should stop or should reduce, is really the right word he used, reliance on the U.S. dollar, and they should avoid following America into a conflict with China. He was on his plane ride back to Paris. He was on a three-day state visit with the Chinese dictator there, Xi Jinping. And President Macron, he expressed his desire to become the world's third superpower. And of course, you know, with France in a leadership position, he wants the EU all united. And he's been a leading proponent right now of the formation of a fully fledged EU army. And he emphasized this need for what he calls strategic autonomy for Europe, rather than being at the whims of Washington. And this comes right on the heels of a very, you know, long visit with Xi Jinping. And his comments also were kind of concerning. I'm a little worried about the future of our dollar. We'll see where it goes. He said the use of the dollar as a world's reserve currency. He says Europe should look to reduce its dependency on it. Should look to reduce its dependency, and I'll quote him here, on the extraterritoriality of the U.S. dollar. And of course, that is music to the ears of Moscow and Beijing, both of whom have been seeking to undermine the petrodollar for a long time. A little quick history here. The petrodollar, I don't know if you're familiar with it, it has the backbone of the global economy, at least since 1973 when President Nixon made a deal with Saudi Arabia to only trade oil in U.S. dollars. And it was a move that was quickly adopted by the Organization of Petrol Exporting Countries, or OPEC. And the system has come under a lot of, I guess, threat lately from so-called BRIC alliances of emerging economies. You got Brazil, you've got Russia, India, China, South Africa. They all went off it, right? And they've been actively attempting to convince major oil suppliers in other countries to accept currencies besides the dollar. I think I just read earlier in the week that Saudi Arabia has agreed to do that. But the main buffer to the collapse of the petrodollar, and by the way, if this happened, it would be disastrous to our economy. I mean, we have the most robust economy in the planet right now, right? It would be disastrous to our future. And the real buffer has been the fact that the EU has continued to back it, continue to conduct trades for oil in American currency. But here's Macron saying, hey, we got to get off it. And you got all these BRIC nations saying the same thing. I don't know where this is going to go. I'm not an economist. I certainly want to talk to one a little bit later in the week about this. It's going to affect you. It's going to affect your retirement. It's going to affect your children. It's going to affect their future. You know, when Joe Biden took office, he promised to return to very close cooperation with our allies. You know, Trump allegedly, reportedly, had ruffled the feathers of Europe over what I think is very sane and important demands. He wanted NATO powers such as France and Germany to pay their required defense spending. Right, the U.S. was digging deep in their own pockets. You and I are paying for their defense. No, he says you got to put up your own money. And you know what they did? They started to do that. Of course, President Trump is no longer in office, and we see how the current administration just loves to spend money. Right, we see where we are in terms of inflation. Emmanuel Macron also argued that Europe shouldn't follow America into a potential war with China. Now, what about the NATO Charter, Article 5, you know, an attack on one is an attack on all. What if we went in there? What if Beijing launched an invasion on Taiwan, which although is not a technical U.S. ally on paper, it has been, I would argue unofficially under our protection. So what will the U.S. do, as I said, as I began? I don't know. Well, you know, I saw an interview with Men on the Street. They did a reporter was there interviewing people and basically said a lot of the people there don't believe the U.S. is going to come to their aid. They don't. Honestly, I don't want to see a third world war. I certainly don't want to see a conflict with China. That's for sure. But Macron, he sees this. He calls it a great risk if Europe gets caught up in a crisis that's not theirs. And again, he uses the word strategic autonomy from building their own strategic autonomy. He says the paradox would be that overcome a panic, we believe that we're just America's followers, he said. The question Europeans need to answer, is it in our interest to accelerate a crisis on Taiwan? No, he says the worst thing would be to think that Europeans must become followers on the topic and take their cue from the U.S. agenda and a Chinese overreaction. So we'll see what happens in the future. I said tomorrow I'll dive into that in greater details. France has its own turmoil. I don't know if you caught any of the news there. I don't know whether Macron's in a position to lead Europe on these issues, given the fact that millions of French people have taken to the streets. I think it's 11 days now against his administration. They wanted to raise the minimum age for Social Security. I think to 62. I think it's at 60. That did not go well. And you could see the chaos that's over there. But look, that's another conversation for us tomorrow. But again, I go back and I start my show every day. It seems like we have this same conversation as I get into some of the big international news that's here. We need to pray. We really need to pray. We need to pray for peace. I've been praying every day. My wife had this conversation with me last night because, you know, she says, when I pray, I often pray for, you know, the kids and the family and for this and for that. And she goes through this whole, so everything when we pray sometimes is very, it's our own little microcosm, right? But I think prayer's never wasted, especially when you offer it for others. You know, you pray for others, especially when you pray for big picture issues like the souls in purgatory or the conversion of sinners for peace. Isn't that what Our Lady in Fatima asked for? And we should be doing that right now, both for Russia and for China. You know, China's leaders, as we know, seem to be bent on world dominance and in ways that are totally unconventional. Jim Garrity at National Review reported yesterday that a biological weapon China appears to be developing. And I don't know a whole lot about this. It would target people based, now listen to this, it's bizarre, it sounds futuristic, on genetic profiles. They have a weapon that they're in the works on right now that would target people based on a specific genetic profile. It's not developed yet. There's little doubt that they'd use it once it is. You know, who knows? But unfortunately, we cannot rule out its use on a population. You know, we can't. Like the Uyghurs, other minority, other people. Experts like Garrity, you know, he interviewed him. It could be easily used on world leaders like hacking their medical information, which is not hard to do. Plus, China can access all of those genetic profiles on sites like 23andMe. That's, I don't know if you had your genealogy done. Can you imagine identifying your genetic profile and then being able to target specific people with that? Meg, I'm not quite sure what that's about. Do we have a guest for that? Great, we do. All right, let me take a very short break. When we come back, we'll talk more. There's a lot of news to get into today. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go so far off on Macron and China and all that's unfolding. But again, I don't know about you, my spirit, I have this deep yearning in my spirit to pray. I do, especially for the world. I just think we are at a crossroads. This is me personally. I really think we are at a crossroads, and we're seeing it. You know, I'm going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to my next guest. What happened in Rwanda, Africa, before the genocide, and this is the anniversary of when that took place. It was during this week. There was a demonic outbreak of vandalism and church destructions, destruction of statues, attacks on churches, attacks on people. When I return, I want to talk to you a little bit about something I think you'll find quite interesting, something I've been following. The Family Research Council is showing an escalation in attacks on churches just in the first, you know, 3 months of this year. I want to paint that picture for you, okay? Just, again, don't read too much into it. I think it's a call for all of us to pray, to be at peace. I don't want to rob you of your peace, but these are the signs of the times. I'll give you another look when I return.
Your news, the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Your news now.
Hey, looking for a new job? How about one that offers opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/forester. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the Brooklyn Bridge, Drew Mariani is on your radio now. Your life connected coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
It is good to be with you today. Thank you for joining me. So much to talk about here. Quick update for you. Some justice is being served when it comes to these attacks on Catholic churches. I told you about the one that took place in Nebraska the other day. It was an act of vandalism. Occurred on Palm Sunday. A guy named Travis Ross was actually arrested by the sheriff's office there after video evidence and witnesses actually led to name him as a suspect. And the priest there, Father Ryan Salisbury, he said that, you know, when he walked in the church, he discovered the altar had been tipped over, the statue has been desecrated. Several other objects have been desecrated. A Sacred Heart of Jesus statue was broken beyond repair, and a candlestick there was damaged on the altar stone as well. This is going on over and over. I seem to be reporting on it nonstop. I told you yesterday about another Catholic church in California that was attacked that same night. Those two attacks are just part of a continual stream that's happening against churches now all over the country. Yesterday, the FRC, the Family Research Council, they released an update to their report. They came out with a report in December of 2022 on hostility against churches. And they had to update it because there had been so many attacks just in the first quarter of this year that they needed to let people know how bad it was. And the new report indicates that criminal acts against churches, they have been steadily on the rise now for the past several years. But the first quarter of 2023, there has been a major spike upwards. And the question is, why, right? What is driving this? What is driving this? That's the big question. There are approximately three times the number of acts of hostility penetrating against churches compared to the same time frame last year. And according to their findings, there were 69 acts of hostility against churches through March of just this year. So the rate continues. Let's talk about it. You know, 53 acts of vandalism, 10 acts of arson. You know, the list goes on and on. FRC's been tracking these. I'm joined right now by the director for the Center for Religious Liberty and the author of the report, Ariel Del Turco. She is FRC's director there of Center for Religious Liberty. Ariel, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stunning stuff. You know, I continue to follow. I've been reporting on this for several years, but just I'd argue the last 18 months, I've seen a radical increase in the number of attacks in both in frequency and intensity against churches, against houses of the religious. What is driving this? I mean, to me, it's astounding. You've been tracking it 6 years. Have you seen anything like this before?
Yeah, well, like you, we just have seen this anecdotal evidence of these attacks that seem to be mounting, and so we wanted to put numbers to that and actually do the digging and find out how bad this was. And we found out that it's getting really bad, and as you said, over the last year or two, it's really, really spiked. So you mentioned that we've had 69 acts of hostility against churches just from January through March of this year alone, which is three times the number in the same time frame last year, but it's also much higher than the previous 3 months, the last quarter of 2022, when there were only 54 acts. So this is a serious, serious spike that we're watching, and it's deeply concerning for anyone who cares about religious freedom.
What do you think is driving it?
You know, I think there are a lot of factors. First, I think a factor is simply the increasing secularization in our society. Yep. We're living in a country where people are less and less religious. It's less a part of our public life. It's less a part of our media. People aren't exposed to religion, and so they don't understand the significance of it. They don't have any respect for it, and they especially don't have respect for religion when it conflicts with the secular dogma. Mm-hmm. And some of these issues like abortion or same-sex marriage or any restraints that religion might put on our behavior for our own good. So these issues that are birthed out of the secular revolution, whenever they conflict with what the church is saying, the secular culture just has less and less tolerance for it.
You know, I think you are so spot on. I think it was very eloquently said, and I think that's exactly where this is being birthed. My frustration also comes not only as we're seeing a rise in this, but law enforcement. You know, I can't even remember the number of attacks on pro-life centers, let alone arsons and vandalism within churches. And you might hear of an occasional arrest. What is law enforcement, especially federal law enforcement, doing about this? Is there a certain apathy there? I don't want to mischaracterize them if I'm wrong in that. Just from the reports that I'm seeing, the news that I follow, I'm not hearing much follow-up in these cases.
Yeah, well, a lot of the cases that we've tracked, law enforcement was investigating, has made arrests. But there's clearly a disconnect here when law enforcement is pursuing the case, we're still not seeing these cases decrease. There's a certain problem with deterrence where the punishment or maybe the lack of punishment that these criminals are being doled out, it's not enough to deter further action from would-be criminals. And some of these people are doing this intentionally. Some of them are sincerely hateful. They want to intimidate and scare Christians. But a lot of this is just rage against the church, this inexplicable anger that people are feeling to attack churches, desecrate churches. And a lot of these pastors, they just don't know where it's coming from.
Maybe I'm wrong on this. To me, it seems disproportionately targeted at Catholic churches. At least that's what I'm seeing in my news feeds. Is that my perception? I know there's been vandalism to Protestant and Jewish synagogues as well, but it seems that the majority of these things seem to be targeted at Catholic churches. Is that accurate?
No, I think you're absolutely right. The majority of incidents that we've recorded as well have been against Catholic churches. And I think there might be a few reasons for it. Partially, it's just the beauty of the Catholic Church, churches. They're a very prominent outward statement of the Catholic faith, the Christian faith, of what they stand for. They have statues outside. It just makes them easy targets. But also, I think the Catholic Church has been especially stalwart on the pro-life issue, especially. But all of these issues really that touch against, as I said, the dogma of the secular revolution. And there's just no tolerance for it anymore.
That's well said. So, your final thoughts here. I mean, what's our response as Christians supposed to be? I mean, where do we go from here? This is going to continue. I mean, I don't know what stems the tide of it. How do you view that? And, you know, what's your big takeaway?
Well, there's a role for all of us to play here. Religious freedom doesn't just rely on good laws, although it needs that, but also on cultural support. So we need to build that cultural support simply by living our faith in public, by not being intimidated from going to church, from identifying as a Christian in public. All of this is just exercising that cultural muscle that is really going to strengthen religious freedom and religious toleration.
Amen to that. Well, if people want to read your report, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, you can see the report on our homepage at frc.org.
All right, sounds great. Hey, Ariel, thank you. Thanks for what you're doing. Keep on it, okay? We'll continue to cover it and give it some air. It's important.
Thanks so much.
That's Ariel, Ariel Del Turco, and you can check them out at frc.org. Check out the attacks on those churches. It'll give you a big perspective in terms of the gravity, the intensity, the frequency of what's happening. And again, you know, I'm glad to be able to give you a look at life that you're not going to get anywhere else and kind of give voice to something that, you know, is being reported, but a lot of people go throughout the day and never hear about any of this. A lot of people are quite shocked to hear about how long this has been going on and the fact that it's now even on the rise. Hey, I want to take a look at one other issue, the Pentagon. I don't know if you heard about this story or not. Look, the Pentagon's a place where secrets abound, right? And for good reason. And you don't want your enemies, sometimes even your allies, to know what you're up to. So it's not a good thing when someone leaks out top secret information, top secret documents that lay out war plans or discussions about what our allies are doing and not doing. Unfortunately, that's happened again. You'll probably recall Edward Snowden. Remember that case? He leaked out a ton of information from the Pentagon because he wasn't happy with the plans that they had. And someone else has done the same thing, though. Took a while for anybody to realize this. The New York Times reported that, well, these papers were leaked out, but they were just kind of sitting out on the web unrecognized for a few weeks before somebody finally figured out what was going on. And what they revealed was disturbing. The Washington Post reported that most have classified markings. Some are labeled no form, N-O-F-O-R, meaning that they cannot be released to foreign nationals. Other states, you know, other of these documents state that they're meant to be shared with just close U.S. allies, including the Five Eyes Alliance. That's Britain, it's Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And some, of course, are marked top secret. And most of the information in the documents was gathered over the winter and published in late February and early March. So it doesn't necessarily represent our current view, but the documents are largely focused on the war in Ukraine, the fighting that's going on in there. But the detail, you know, is well, the detail, how am I going to phrase this? They detail the fraught geopolitical situations, including assessments of China and Iran. And there are also documents about South Korea and Israel, and including whether or not South Korea will sell armaments to Ukraine and pushing for citizens in Israel to protest against planned judicial reforms. This is stuff you do not want leaked on the web. Part of the leak shows that the U.S., you know, our military intelligence has penetrated Russia enough to be able to forewarn Ukraine about coming attacks, which means that our assets are going to now be in big trouble as soon as they find this out. Anytime that type of information is out, it's major, major trouble. So let's talk about it. Now, joining me right now is Victoria Coates. She's Senior Research Fellow for International Affairs and National Security in the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation. Hey, Victoria, thank you for joining me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. Good to be with you.
This is a pretty amazing story. It's a big story. I know, I think it was Fox News was reporting that the leaked documents could have come from outside the Pentagon. Initially, I thought it was maybe leaked from the Pentagon. If that's true, Does that mean somebody else has had, I guess, access to classified information? And what does that mean now for how secure the Pentagon is? And maybe, please fill in the gaps. You know, maybe you can articulate what's happening here in a more eloquent way. So if you could address those two issues, it'd be great.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think there is an eloquent way to address what has happened. It's deeply disconcerting. You know, the number of people who have access to this material in, you know, non-paper form, so you're not being given a briefing book, you can actually print it.
Right.
And that's a limited number of computer terminals. So they can start narrowing it down that way, and then those with access to the correct printers, because you can't just hook this up to some Bluetooth printer and print it out. So there will be some kind of a trail of who accessed these materials and who printed them out. And, you know, figuring that out and shutting this down, I think, has to be our top priority, because, as you said, you know, this affects some of our most sensitive relationships. And this is a sacred trust from the American people to be given access to this information. And the point of the sacred trust is to keep them safe. Yeah. And this is the opposite of that.
Yeah, a lot of this material has to do with the war in Ukraine. What kind of picture, I guess, is a paint of that war versus what we're hearing from the media? You know, I was hearing about troop losses, and I was, you know, the reports we're getting here in the States is that Russia's losing a lot of troops. I understand that's not necessarily the case, that Ukraine may be actually losing a lot more. What kind of picture does it paint of the war in Ukraine right now, these documents versus what we're hearing?
Well, if there's any kind of silver lining to this, I think the very sober reality, the portrait they paint of what is happening to our supplies of ammunition and other, you know, critical supplies is running dangerously low. And our ability to resupply Ukraine in terms of particularly of missile defense may be in jeopardy. And that becomes doubly concerning when we think about the fact that, you know, we have very aggressive Chinese behavior towards Taiwan right now. And so, you know, that could hopefully refocus everyone's attention on what is being committed to Ukraine. And I don't object to it being committed to Ukraine, but I'm very concerned we are preventing ourselves from being able to respond to Chinese incursion on Taiwan. And that's what Xi is reading in these papers.
Yeah, Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood from Heritage has joined me in the past, and he's, in fact, it was probably 2-3 weeks ago, maybe even longer, talked about the depletion of our missiles and much of the armament that we have, you know, in our own supplies, because we were sending them over to Ukraine. And look, China's becoming very aggressive in the Taiwanese Straits, and I'm very concerned about where that might lead. What does Xi Jinping think when he sees this type of thing happen, and how do you think China is viewing this data leak? What's it tell them about us?
Oh, for them, this is like catnip for a cat. You know, that whole regime is based on, you know, information, data harvesting. You know, the more of that they can get, the better. And if they get a good look at some of our secrets, you know, that's best of all. It's why the whole spy balloon episode was so confusing.
Yeah, that's for sure.
The administration told us it was nothing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, go ahead.
No, you were breaking up just a little bit. If you could repeat the last sentence, that'd be great.
Oh, no problem. You know, that the spy balloon episode in February was so concerning. And even though the administration told us not to be concerned, I think we should be concerned.
Yeah.
And so for them, getting a look at our secrets is the best of all possible results.
Yeah, no kidding. I was a little surprised when I heard about our situation with Israel. Why is the U.S. interfering with the internal affairs of Israel? I think our connection with Victoria is a little fraught. Victoria, I'm not sure whether you can hear me or not. I'm going to
just... Yes, I can.
Okay, good. I think we may have lost you. I know your connection's a little shoddy right now. Your thoughts on U.S. interfering with the internal affairs of Israel? I mean, that was another big takeaway from this data leak.
Yeah. And just cut me off if I start to break up, because this is a really important topic. The history of the State Department trying to interfere in internal Israeli politics has a long and undistinguished history. And going back to the Obama administration, when there were efforts to undermine the reelection of Ben and now Prime Minister Netanyahu. And it's really a problem for those of us who understand the value and significance of this relationship. We should not be meddling. And so to have, you know, a situation right now when we have Israel coming under attack, literally, from various Iranian proxies, this is a terrible time for this to come out.
Yeah, no kidding. I was stunned when I saw that report. Well, one final note here. South Korea. I understand they weren't very happy with what was leaked about them either. There was a lot of information in these leaks, and maybe there's more to come. How does the U.S. soothe those relationships where many of our allies thought we had their back? Now they find out that there were other movements behind the scenes.
Yeah, and that's been also really concerning, Drew, is if you think about where these documents touch, you know, Israel, Ukraine, now South Korea, which obviously is very close to Taiwan, you know, it's as if this is a concerted attempt to roil key relationships at a very dangerous time. And so it would be an opportunity to dump information, but rather as a concerted attempt to undermine us. And so that's really what we should keep an eye out for.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Well, Victoria, I want to thank you for your time. I really do. I appreciate you joining us today. And if people want to learn more, I guess the best place to go is just heritage.org. If they want to learn a little bit more about this?
Yes, they're at Victoria Coates on Twitter. And I promise you, if you have me back, I'll be joining you from the Heritage Studio, and the connection will be clear as a bell.
I've been there. I love it. And thank you. I know you're in the midst of traveling. But your Twitter handle, again, is at Victoria Coates, C-O-A-T-E-S.
Yep.
All right,
yes,
great. Go follow her now and get plugged in. You'll be glad you did. Hey, Victoria, thank you. Have a great one. That's Victoria Coates. She's Senior Research Fellow for International Affairs and National Security in the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation. Again, boy, as we take a look at so much of these international affairs, I really didn't expect to talk as much about this today, but it seems to be the predominant issue of the day. It does raise other questions, I mean, about the administration. President Biden has indicated once again that he does plan to run for election. Is that a good thing for our country in terms of the international scene? Was Donald Trump a little bit better? Should we have some fresh faces and some fresh blood? What President Biden is saying, he says, yeah, I plan to run next year, but yeah, I'm not going to make the formal announcement just yet. So remember back, I think it was over the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, he was going to talk to his family about it. Jill Biden also has indicated, yeah, her husband's going to run. Why would you want to run? I said to somebody the other day, I was talking about this. I said, you know, power must be very intoxicating. You know, when I'm his age, I want to hang out with my wife. I want to enjoy, you know, he's got a Rehoboth beach home. Why not go to the beach? Why not hang out with family, your kids, your grandkids, travel, enjoy the wealth that you have amassed? There's something about power, something about pride. You know, and look, I'm not just pointing at Joe Biden. Don't misinterpret me. You see Donald Trump wanting to run again as well. What motivates that? Donald Trump has all the money in the world, too. Is it because in your heart you really think you can make the country better? I hope that's it. I hope it arises out of a place of a place that's true and good, not out of selfish motivations. The Joe Biden's, he told NBC's Al Roker he was not prepared to make a statement about when he's going to run, but the announcement seems to be put off a couple times now, and indications are that President Biden may not even make the announcement until the fall. Now, maybe there's a strategy behind this. I haven't really thought about it much. I haven't dove into it. What would be the strategy of not making the announcement yet? Is it to hold somebody who might challenge you off? So far, only two Democrats have challenged him. One is that Marianne Wilson. She's that new age woman. Remember her on the debate scene last time? The other is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I think he might have a shot if he gets in there. But nobody else has really thrown their hat in the ring yet. And if he says he's not going to run, you're going to see a lot of hats, right? But if he does run, does everybody make the way for him? Does he think he could beat Donald Trump? Could he beat Ron DeSantis? What do you think can happen? Who knows? I don't know. The president did sign a bill yesterday ending the COVID national emergency. This is the other thing that I was struck by the president's doing. This is a big deal, right? You have a pandemic on average, what, once every 100 years, something of this magnitude. The last one was 1908. He shut the government down. Well, not just him. The Trump administration began it, but he continued to extend this. 3 years. It was 3 years this pandemic national emergency was in effect. And it gave, you know, the former president, Trump issued the proclamation in March 2020 to temporarily to expand the executive branch's power and to steer funds to battle the virus. And it's unclear what immediate effect the new law is going to have on, linked U.S. policies. For example, Title 42, we got immigration, we got student debt forgiveness, all these things that COVID was going to give cover to. Well, now that the COVID pandemic's over, how does it affect those things? In January, the White House said that Biden would end both the national emergency and a separate public health emergency on May 11th. So this comes about a month early. So we'll see what happens. Just a little more news for you there. I'm going to take a short pause. When we come back, we will talk more. We got a lot to get into. The chaplet is straight ahead, too. So if you want to join us, feel free to dial in. Number here is 888-914-9149. We'll pray the chaplet in about 20 minutes. We will continue our novena. It is day 5. I'm loving that, right? Can't wait for the Feast of Divine Mercy. It is my absolute favorite day. All right, we'll be back with more right after this.
This hour is sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More information, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
Somehow it doesn't mean very much unless you've got someone to share it with.
This is the Drew Mariani Show, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. Coming up next.
Well, it's good to be with you today. Thank you for joining me. We'll pray the chaplet coming up in about 15 minutes. We'll continue our novena, that novena of chaplets that the Lord asked St. Faustina to pray. Of course, this Sunday is Divine Mercy Sunday, and on Friday we'll do a lot explaining what the Feast of Mercy is all about, how you can tap into the extraordinary promise that the Lord gave, and so much more. I was at Mass this morning and was listening to the Gospels, and I was thinking about some of those early characters of the Gospels, and Mary Magdalene is one of those great saints. She was called the Apostle to the Apostles, and she played such a pivotal role in really the Easter story. We know who the most important woman in human history was, right? Our Lady, right? So who would be the second most important woman? It's debatable. But I think you can make a case for Saint, you know, Saint Mary Magdalene, right? I think you could. In fact, was it last year or the year before Pope Francis gave Mary Magdalene a canonical rank equivalent to that of the apostles? And I think her feast day is July 22nd. And there's even a change on the Roman calendar. But Mary Magdalene, it's amazing how little we really know about her, right? She must have come, they believe, from Magdala. It's a little village in Galilee. They've recently done some excavations there. And she grew up along, if you're not familiar with the area, the sandy shores where the apostles were called to be fishers of men. And there's where the speculation begins. The Gospels are full of Marys, right? And it can get confusing. Not sure which one she was. Was Mary Magdalene the woman caught in adultery? Was she rescued by Jesus with his demand that a sinless person cast the first stone? Was she the sister of Martha, who sat by Christ's feet to hear his teaching? Did she anoint him before his death, weeping, wiping his feet with her hair? Some believe that Mary was called Magdalene. She was one who had the seven demons that Luke 8 tells us about, right? And Christ cast those seven demons out of her. Luke introduces her, a woman who'd been healed of the evil spirits and those infirmities. Some scholars identify Magdalene with a sinful woman who, anointed the feet of Christ. But there are numerous scriptures about her. I love her, and I love what she represents, You know, she's one of these heroic women, brave women who were there at Christ's crucifixion. You know, can you imagine that? She was a follower of Christ. She accompanied and ministered to Christ. She heard his teachings, right? She was there with the apostles. The Gospels record her as being one of the women present there as Christ uttered his last words. And who was she? Was she best known for? She's best known for witnessing the resurrection, right? She was the first one there. The Gospels say that she went to the tomb that early Easter morning. And when she saw the tomb was empty, she stood out there weeping. She loved Christ. And what happened? Christ appeared to her. And he asked, "Woman, why are you weeping? Who are you looking for?" And she didn't recognize him, right? She did not recognize him. It's one of the great mysteries of these post-resurrection appearances, right? She thought he was a gardener until he said her name. He said, "Mary." And upon hearing that, what the scripture tells us, her eyes were open. Mary recognized him. She returned quickly to grieving the disciples, rejoicing, saying, "Hey, he's alive. I saw him." You know, she announced the resurrection to the apostles. That's why she is the apostle to the apostles. But, you know, you got to remember on the road to Emmaus, you'll hear that story coming up soon too. The apostles didn't recognize. Their heart burned. It leapt, right, when Christ was with them. But there was a temporal blindness, you know? And again, the great question too is when he tells her not to cling to him, or I have not yet ascended. I think it was Pope Benedict XVI, he said Magdalene's presence beneath the cross on Good Friday, as well as how she was the one to discover the empty tomb on Easter morning, truly makes her a heroic figure. What do we know about her? You know, there's a lot of beautiful parallels, both that we see, you know, in terms of both at Christ's birth and his rebirth. You know, Jesus' first intimate moments were shared with a woman named Mary, of course, a Blessed Virgin Mary. And, of course, I love the thing about the beauty of the Catholic Church is that it holds women in high place, doesn't it? It holds them in a very, very high place. We talked yesterday about the proofs of the resurrection. Women had no standing in the time of Christ whatsoever, you know, especially in courts. You know, the word had no credibility, and yet Mary Magdalene was the first one to see him. And I love that. I love that about her. She is the patron saint of lots of different things. What did I see? She was the patron saint of the other day. Oh, you know what she's the patron saint of, Maggie? I was just reading it the other day. Let me see if I can find it. I had it here not too long ago. I think somebody said she's the patron saint of hairdressers. I don't know why. Of repentant sinners is another. Here it is. Let me go. Mary Magdalene. Here we go. Here it is. This is what always surprised me. Her litany of patrons, hairstylists, penitent sinners. Okay, people ridiculed for their piety. I love that one. Right. Perfumers, pharmacists. I don't know why she's the patron saint of pharmacists. Of course, women, patron saint of the contemplative life, of converts, and of glove makers. So, I don't know why, but, you know, today is a great day to turn to her and ask in a particular way her intercession. I think she's a great person to ask intercession for, especially if you've got a loved one away from the faith. And I would strongly, strongly encourage you to turn to her and ask her for that type of intercession. Because, you know, the greater the sinner, the Lord told St. Faustina, the greater the right that they have to his mercy. And we see that in the scriptures here, don't we? We see that played out so beautifully. You know, we can't doubt that God chooses particular moments of revelation and care. He knows your heart, and he knows my heart. And God, you know, when we talk about concealing himself, sometimes we feel like God's not around us. We can't see God in the midst of our storm. We can't see him when we're grieving. And yet God's there. You know, God is there, and we'll get these beautiful but brief glimpses sometime. Be assured that God is always there. You know, he is always there for you. In fact, when we come back, we'll pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. For those of you who have not yet joined me, it is not too late to pray this prayer. In fact, this is such a unique novena, and I've said this again and again. I know audience always changes, people come and go, but this is a novena that the Lord himself specifically requested from St. Faustina. And he asked us for 9 days to bring souls to the fountain of his mercy. And he wants you to, he says, draw refreshment, draw strength, draw whatever grace you need in the hardship of life, but especially the hour of death, he says. He says, every day bring to me a different group of souls and immerse them in my mercy. And he's going to bring them to the house of the Father. And he asks you to beg, you know, the Father on the strength of his passion and his death for graces for that soul. And of course, today we'll talk about the souls of those who have been separated from God. He wants us to bring souls who've separated them from the church. And I think what a perfect day for this, right? We just talked about Mary Magdalene, this great convert to the faith. What a great day to pray for your brother or your sister or your son or daughter or your spouse, right? Or that loved one that you have that is away. The Lord said that during his passion, those who separated themselves from the church, they tore at his body. They tore at his heart. And, you know, when they return to Unity Church, he says his wounds heal. They alleviate his passion. So I love that. Maggie, you've always had a deep devotion to Mary Magdalene. I know that she was one of your favorite or patron saints. Didn't your mom pray to her, or were you praying to her?
She was my confirmation saint.
And why did you choose her?
I knew she had a presence in the gospel, and I always thought that she seemed very courageous. I didn't honestly know too much about her at that age, so I just chose to keep my name Margaret Mary and tack Magdalene on the end. So it kind of got Margaret Mary, aliquot, but then also Mary Magdalene. I remember the bishop when he went, "Oh, that's a powerful name," and I was like, "Thank you."
So during your own conversion process, did you pray to her at all? Or what?
Afterwards, what for sure.
Afterwards.
Yes.
So your mom was praying, right?
Yes.
And then what happened? You ended up receiving the grace, I'm assuming, from your mom's prayers.
Yes.
From God.
And it was shortly after having my conversion that I had read, I think it's Fulton Sheen said this, if you have the audacity to mimic, if you have the bravery to mimic Mary Magdalene in her sins, have the bravery to mimic Mary Magdalene in her repentance. Wow. And that just like cut me to the core. And I carried that quote with me for quite a bit.
Was it hard forgiving yourself at all or not really?
It was just like a radical conversion of what had been filling me with bitterness before kind of just melted away into pure appreciation and gratefulness that that he loved me that much, even when I was such, it sounds like it's like a song, like even when I was such a wreck, like that he loved me that much.
It's beautiful.
So it really made those stories come alive where she can't help herself but anoint his feet with oil, you know, anoint him with oil and wipe his feet and kiss his, you know, feet with her tears and hair. Like it just totally made sense to me.
I love her. I was, you know, I think she's an inspiration for a lot of souls. I think she's important for marriages. I shared with you the story of the exorcist that I knew. There's an exorcist I know in Arizona who took a trip with me, and he told me about a man who was possessed. And they were involved in this exorcism with him. And an exorcism isn't like you go in and say a few prayers and the demon leaves. In some cases, it can be. Sometimes it takes a long time. Mm-hmm. And John Paul II, even as powerful as he was, had to, you know, it took multiple times with this one woman that he dealt with. But this particular possessed man had a girlfriend. He was not faithful. He was an adulterer. He lived a very, very sinful life. And there was a spirit within him. I forget the name of the spirit. The priest had told me, whichever one that was, you know. And what's that sexual spirit? Do you know the one, the name of it? I can't think of it off.
Lilith or something like that?
I can't remember which one it was. Anyway, whatever it was, you know, it identified itself. And they did this battle, and they went on for a long time. And finally, the man was exhausted, and the priests that were in there were a couple of priests there. This guy, by the way, was like a former Green Beret or Navy SEAL. And at one point in time, this guy, the possessed man, got the priest in a position where he had his head. And if the demon or if the person wanted to, he says he could have killed me. He says he could have just crushed my head, slammed me right at the edge of this chair. But of course, you know, God's going to protect him. And when the exorcism is over, the guy falls to the ground. He's on the ground. He's kind of in a baby fetal position. He's just exhausted. And the priests thought, wow, this is over. This is fantastic. So they had brought relics into the exorcism with them. And one of them was that of Mary Magdalene. And the priest said to the wife, because she was there too, they brought her in to be present for this because they're connected through marriage. And he says, here, this is a relic of St. Mary Magdalene. You know, if you want to kiss it, go ahead and do that. The second she touched that, he went back into another demonic fury, right? And they realized that the spirit had not yet left him. But the priest said to me, you know, they called upon Mary Magdalene after that, and they were actually able to exorcise the spirit completely. But he says, it shows me the power of that sacramental bond, that the husband and wife together, there's something there. When the wife touched this sacrament, you know, this relic, I should say, of Mary Magdalene, kissed it and invoked her intercession, we saw what happened. So he says, whenever I give pre-canon lessons, I often tell the story of the connection between these two people. What happens when you allow infidelity in, the power of conversion, forgiveness, and the intercession of the saints. Let's pray the chaplet when I come back. We'll talk more.